Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the massacre in the historic AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, perpetrated by a young white racist who murdered the pastor and eight parishioners with a handgun recently given to him by his father as a birthday present. John Hale, a professor of civil rights history at the College of Charleston and author of the forthcoming book, The Freedom Schools, A History of Student Activists During the Civil Rights Movement, joins us to discuss the historic significance of the church where this flagrant hate crime took place and the overlooked threat from right-wing terrorists that the country faces. Then we'll examine the disastrous breakdown of emergency talks in Luxembourg between European finance ministers and the Greek government that ended in acrimony and recriminations. With a run underway on Greek banks as depositors grab up euros before the last-minute talks resume on Monday when Greek banks are not likely to be open, we are joined by Andre Gerolimatis, the chair of Hellenic Studies at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. He focuses on the political and social history of modern Greece, and we'll discuss what can be done to pull Greece back from the brink. Then finally, we'll speak with J.J. Messner, the executive director of the Fund for Peace, where he just co-authored their latest report, Fragile States Index 2015, which is published by both the Fund for Peace and Foreign Policy. He joins us to discuss the ranking of the world's countries that are moving towards stability or closer to collapse, with some bright spots like Cuba, Georgia, and Portugal, and a lot of sad cases like South Sudan, the worst ranked, and Syria, which is going from bad to worse. And joining us now is John Hale, who's a professor of civil rights history at the College of Charleston in Charleston, South Carolina, and the author of the forthcoming book, The Freedom Schools, A History of Student Activism During the Civil Rights Movement. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Hale.
Thank you.
And obviously this hideous massacre in a house of worship that itself has an extraordinary history is so tragic and it's so full of irony, given the history of African Americans trying to worship and the notion that a church from its inception for African Americans who were excluded from the mainstream Protestant churches in the United States, the very notion of a church as a sanctuary means so much more, does it not, to African Americans?
Yes, the church in the black community is absolutely a sacred, holy place and also a very safe place. If you look at specifically the history of the AME Church, which dates back to 1787, you know, African Americans who were excluded from white churches, or actually in the case in Philadelphia, they were allowed in the church, but, you know, they were segregated within the church. So they created it on their own terms with their own beliefs, and, you know, it just catered to the specific and unique needs of the black community. So it was a tremendously important place, and then has just grown in importance and significance over time. Well, so that this happened at an AME church is extremely significant and really just a devastating blow to the African-American community.
And the killer actually sat with the pastor, did he not, throughout the whole Bible study session for an hour?
Yeah, all confirmed reports suggest he was there for about an hour before he stood up, made a statement, and began shooting the you know, congregation in attendance. So, yeah, it was a very, just a heinous, evil crime.
And he methodically reloaded his revolver five times. Apparently, this was a birthday present from his father for his 21st birthday.
Yeah, from his father in April. So it's a handgun. He had to reload several times. So it's not something that we saw or we observed in Sandy Hook, where he had an arsenal of weapons. This is just a handgun, which is very accessible. No one questions having a handgun, especially in South Carolina. So we really see a set of implications for the fact that it was a simple handgun used in this crime.
Well, apparently, ironically, on the front page of the Charleston Daily newspaper, there is the story broke, of course, it happened at 9 p.m., last night, and it's a front page story, needless to say, in the local paper in Charleston, but also on the front page, apparently there's a big advertisement for guns right next to the story.
Yeah, you're exactly right. South Carolina is a typical gun-owning state. They're proud of the right to own weapons. You see advertisements everywhere. You see gun shops, you know, up and down all county roads here in Charleston and South Carolina. So it's ironic, but sadly it's not surprising to see something like that. And also in South Carolina, Governor Nikki Haley just signed into law a body camera law, and this is a result of the Walter Scott shooting. So we see law enforcement, you know, trying to take some type of position to cut down on gun violence. And the week before, the state legislature passed a domestic abuse law, which strengthened prison sentences and terms for people who commit domestic violence. And the biggest issue there was they were concerned that they were going to infringe upon the rights of gun owners. So gun ownership is a major issue in South Carolina, and this is just going to eventually come to the fore in terms of how do we proceed with gun ownership? Should we put limits on it? And it's going to become it's already started to become this, a big statewide discussion.
Well, you mentioned Governor Nikki Haley, who's often referred to as a Tea Party governor. Her first statement on her Facebook page was a little confusing and somewhat ambivalent, suggesting that this is a terrible tragedy and we'll never understand why it happened. Well, I think we do understand why it happened. It's pretty damn clear, isn't it?
Very clear. So, and she was actually spoke in Charleston this morning at the Morris Brown AME Church, and she's expressing a lot of support for the community. But yes, the statement about not understanding why this happened, yes, it is very clear. One, you know, it has to do with gun ownership and the fact that, you know, the killer had a gun. It was easy accessible. It was even a gift. And the other, this is racism. You know, race and racism penetrate Southern politics and social relationships to a degree that we have to begin to recognize. Now, this is just after 2 months after the Walter Scott shooting, and the community is fed up with trying to get people to see how race operates in society today. So the fact that Governor Haley can say this suggests that at an institutional level, we're really not making the gains that we should be making if we want to progress in 2015.
And again, I'm speaking with John Hale, who's a professor of civil rights history at the College of Charleston in Charleston, South Carolina. And his forthcoming book is The Freedom Schools, A History of Student Activism During the Civil Rights Movement. And the president came out today and spoke about this hideous massacre in the AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, where the preacher, along with his congregants, six women and three men, were killed. The preacher himself is apparently a lawmaker in the legislature in South Carolina. The president was talking about this history of this church, saying this was a church that was burned to the ground because its worshippers worked to end slavery. So tell us about what happened in 1822 when the church's co-founder, Denmark Vesey, fomented a slave rebellion in Charleston, but apparently he was snitched on or something, and he, along with 35 people, were hanged, which, of course, is at the heart of racism, isn't it? In other words, you know, you get punished for wanting your freedom, the ultimate punishment. You know, this is all about keeping people in their place, and that's what this paranoid ranting from this shooter was about, wasn't it? Raping our women and taking over our country, and you got to go. I mean, the notion that somehow the whites are a beleaguered, oppressed minority in this country is so pervasive amongst white racists, and it's so delusional. But can you explain, since you're there in Charleston and close to the scene, this kind of peculiar pathology?
Yeah, it's a pathology, as you mentioned, that goes back to the antebellum period and slave ownership, where, you know, whites develop a mindset that justifies slavery, and then once slavery is abolished, you can justify a legal entrenched system of segregation, and to say that this, you know, will help maintain the peace, if you will, between the races. And then once the civil rights movement comes along and sort of dismantles the legal system of segregation, you have a different mindset develop where people begin to feel that their rights are infringed upon. And the most extreme forms are what the shooter was discussing about, raping our women, which connects to a deep-seated historical fear of black men. And this was used, this ideology was used to justify, you know, the most heinous crimes during Jim Crow, which we see in the epidemic of Southern lynching in the early 20th century. So the killer, right, is reiterating in many ways ideologies that have been passed down for generations among white people to justify a particular social order. Now, he's very extreme, obviously, but you do see today in Charleston discussions of reverse racism, where people of color are making advances only because of the color of their skin. At the same time, you also begin to see, you see a lot of discussions where, of colorblind discussions, where race doesn't exist. So some of the first discourse that emerged from this particular incident is people were saying this has nothing to do with race, this is just pure evil. But clearly this has something to do with race. The evidence we see emerging suggests that this young man was involved in, you know, segregationist, white supremacist organization. So race was a major factor. And then when the survivors speak out and talk about what he was saying before, as you pointed out, you know, race had everything to do with this. So, yes, we do see this pathology among white people to deny the issues of race and racism. And this is just one extreme example of it. But to move forward, we really have to see how race and racism and how white people think about race, how this really permeates our system. And to move forward, we have to understand how that works.
Well, you know, the guy was like a walking billboard for racism, wasn't he? His jacket that he was wearing, and it's also on his Facebook, has the South African flag under apartheid. It also had the Rhodesian flag, and Rhodesia, of course, is now Zimbabwe. His license plate had the Confederate flag, and of course the Confederate flag is an issue in South Carolina itself, isn't it? We're at the nation's capital, there was pressure to move it from the Capitol building, and they moved it, but they made it even more prominent right in the Capitol lawn. So there's obviously a kind of atavistic politics there in the state, isn't there?
Yeah, there certainly is. You know, the decision years ago to move, to keep the Confederate flag, and as you mentioned, move it to a more prominent position in the front lawn of the state courthouse is very symbolic victory in preserving this Confederate type of history. We have numerous prominent buildings or streets, for instance, named after staunch defenders of slavery. So the AME Church, where the shooting occurred last night, was on Calhoun Street. John C. Calhoun is, you know, a strong defender of slavery and helped outline the constitutional principles for secession, which led to the Civil War, et cetera, does not have,
which broke out at Fort Sumter in Charleston, South Carolina.
Broke out, exactly. And, of course, South Carolina being the first state to secede as well from the Union. So we have this very strong history, and history plays a major role in this. And my first reaction to the shooting was that this was to go to this particular church, the AME Church that sits on Calhoun Street, referred to as Mother Emanuel, is the symbol of African-American faith and freedom. Of all the churches in South Carolina, this is the most symbolic church. So to attack this is attacking something. It's attacking the ideas of faith and freedom that support people of color in this state and in this country. So we can't confirm this yet, but I think that that church was selected as a site of terror, specifically because of the history and the symbolism embodied in that church.
But trying, and maybe it's a waste of trying to understand the twisted ideology of this 21-year-old Dylan Storm Roof, mm-hmm. who used the gun recently given to him by his father as a gift on his 21st birthday. The idea that he would, you know, accuse the African-American community of raping our women. I mean, for God's sake, the whole history of slavery in America is about white slave owners raping African women.
Yeah, you see this accusation go back, you know, to slavery. And also when you look at, the phenomenon of Southern lynching, accusations of raping white women were one of the most common reasons that people cited in lynching African Americans. So, yeah, you do, again, see this repetition of ideas and ideologies that have been passed down for generations. And I think it's time that people start to really see that this is what's occurring here, that we do see history playing a major role in the shootings here in Charleston. And yes, people can't just see this as an extreme example. It is extreme, but yet this gets to this discussions we're having in the United States about the status of race. Does race exist? You know, with President Obama as president, people throw out colorblind ideologies. You know, we really have to put race front and center in national discourse right now.
Well, ironically, yesterday we spoke with Professor Kurzman at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, who wrote an op-ed or co-wrote an op-ed in the New York Times recently, pointing out that the real threat in the United States in terms of terrorism is not Al-Qaeda, which is all but extinguished, but rather right-wing domestic terrorists. And, I mean, it feels like this guy fits into that category.
Yeah, he really does. He really does. And that's interesting discussion, too, when the mayor and police chief last night, when they made their first public statement, you know, talks about a hate crime. I mean, I think that's the most basic label you can put on this right now. I think people should start talk about or begin to talk about this as an act of terrorism. And, you know, Dylann Roof represents fundamental right-wing ideology, and you connect this with a strong defense of the right to own weapons in this country, and you have a very dangerous mix. People in America, in my estimation, tend to think that terrorism is something that is limited to the Middle East. But if we can label this as an act of terror, we can begin to see how terrorism is also homegrown and how closely it connects to quote-unquote freedoms that we're willing to die for, such as the right to bear arms. So calling this an act of terrorism, I think, is a powerful move in truly addressing the root causes of the shooting that we experienced last night.
Well, but, you know, when you start calling it like it is, conservatives in this country get hysterical because they think that, you know, you're taking a cheap shot at them. But there is a clear overlap here between much of the ideology of gun ownership and Tea Party politics. After all, you know, here you've got this governor there, although she is clearly of Indian descent, but nevertheless, her followers and the right wing of the Republican Party sprout all kinds of poisonous stuff. They've treated this president of the United States, who's actually tried to reach out to all Americans, with unbelievable and disgusting contempt and racism. So I really think there's a need to get real in this country and have a real debate, as opposed to this sort of phony debate that always erupts when these things happen, when everybody comes together in grief, but they're not really together. There is a connection. I'm not saying that conservatives in this country are responsible for this kind of behavior, but, you know, their ideology does overlap with a lot of this poisonous stuff.
Yeah, it's difficult to point out exactly how something like this is supported, but you can definitely say that certain ideologies and politics do implicitly support this. So, for instance, if you look at our schools, there's a lack of discussion about defining race or discussing how race operates. So people don't have the language to talk about this, and this helps. You know, this creates a system of silence that allows heinous crimes like this to occur. So conservatives, you can't hold conservatives responsible for this, but you can begin to say or to ask people to talk about these issues. How does gun ownership play a role in this? How does, of course, race play a role in this? And there is a conservative backlash, I feel, when you do talk about, when you point to the fact that it's so easy to get a gun, because people think, well, now you're infringing upon my rights. So how do you have this discussion and not feel like you are pushing conservatives or gun owners against the wall here? How do you convey this, that you're not talking about getting rid of all weapons necessarily, but to talk about responsible and common sense gun ownership?
But already on right-wing talk radio, they're talking about, see, this proves that you should be able to carry guns into churches.
So, yeah, I mean...
So, try and win that argument.
Yeah, and we saw the same thing after Sandy Hook, where you talk about arming teachers or putting armed guns in every American school. It's ridiculous. I mean, that type of violent response.
Well, my condolences to you and your community there in Charleston, South Carolina. I thank you for joining us, John Hale.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for covering the story.
And again, I've been speaking with John Hale, who's a professor of civil rights history at the College of Charleston in Charleston, South Carolina. And his forthcoming book is The Freedom Schools, A History of Student Activists During the Civil Rights Movement. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the disastrous breakdown of emergency talks between European finance ministers and the Greek government.
Greece, your pride, telling lies that you're not on your own. Watching faith in prayers will make you see.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Andre Jerilimatos, who is the chair of Hellenic Studies at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, who focuses on the political and social history of modern Greece. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andre Jerilimatos.
Thank you.
And Greece is facing a full-blown banking crisis. I know the sky has been falling for some time. But a meeting Thursday night with all of the Eurozone finance ministers broke down in acrimony and recrimination. Apparently, they're going to meet again on Monday, but it's not a good sign. And meanwhile, money is flying out the door in terms of Greeks taking out deposits from banks inside Greece. A record 1 billion yesterday, euros. I don't know what the total is, but I think it's about
2 billion now.
What is it again?
2 billion.
$2 billion a year in deposits withdrawn so far this week, but I think the total is getting up
to... Oh, the total is in the billions. I mean, one really has a final number.
Right. So clearly this has all of the indications of a run, which is the last thing you need in terms of financial stability. So how do you rate this situation?
Well, the problem is you have both sides who have been posturing now, and they're in very locked positions. And any backtracking on either side would have repercussions in terms of their respective populations. So the Prime Minister of Greece, if he backs down on the pensions, that the Europeans are saying that they want him to scale back the pensions, at the very least raise the age of people collecting pensions, this would cause him a lot of grief with his own people, especially the people who voted for him. The Europeans, for their part, I mean, they have voters who find it... the way the media has been playing it up in Germany and Holland and other EU countries, that, you know, why should we bail out the Greeks? They're a bunch of lazy South Europeans lying in the sun, which is, of course, not true. So, but it's the political posturing that has gotten both sides, I think, in trouble. The only solution right now, I think, is that, A, somebody blinks, literally, or they both blink together and come up with some kind of compromise for the Greek government to pay the IMF at the end of June, because... the head of the IMF, Lagarde, said that she will not extend the deadline. And the other option, I think, right now is really phase one, phase two, which is default within the Eurozone. I think that will calm the European markets and the North American markets. Or default outside the Eurozone, but that means leaving the European Union, because the Maastricht Treaty has no provision for a country to leave the Eurozone unless they leave the European Union. And that would cause a huge uproar in Greece. Most Greeks want to stay within the European Union, and I think that could trigger an election. So an election would bring another government, certainly not this government, and that government may be in a position to renegotiate what's going on.
Well, how much, though, are personalities at play here in these negotiations? Now, when you consider that the Luxembourg talks just broke down, and apparently at the beginning of the Luxembourg talks, Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF, said that there's an urgent need for dialogue with adults in the room, which is clearly a dig at Tsipras and Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis. And then when she introduced herself to the Greek Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis, she introduced herself as the criminal in chief, in reference to Prime Minister Tsipras's claim earlier this week that the IMF bore criminal responsibility for what's happening in Greece.
We know Varoufakis, the Finance Minister of Greece, has been a public relations nightmare, I think, for the Greek government. The man is not very wise. He certainly has no conception of the world outside of Greece, and he really does not appreciate the fact that he is a finance minister of a very small and almost bankrupt country, and at the very least he should have been a rational participant of these conferences. Instead, he's been trying to be a bully. He's been making outrageous statements, like what you said about Lagarde and being the head of a criminal organization. He tries to be outspoken. I think he's taking his notoriety as fame. And certainly he's not going to suffer in the case of a bankruptcy, because he comes from a wealthy family, and he has apartments all over the place and a very nice house on the islands. And also he's got money outside the country. As a lot of Greek newspapers have pointed out, most of the Syriza ministers have taken their money out of the country, like everybody else. So I think he has been a fool, to be blunt about it. He has managed to antagonize the German foreign minister, Schwabel, who ordinarily is a soft-spoken, mild-mannered man who was very sympathetic to Greece until he met Varoufakis.
Well, that's a true disaster. I don't mean to laugh. I mean, it's really tragic.
No, it is. I mean, you're right.
I mean, if you know, anybody knows, no matter how odious you think they are, you've got to be nice to your creditors.
You think, right? I mean, obviously a lesson he's never learned, because I don't think the man has ever worked a day in his life, so he's never had to borrow money. He's never had to make ends meet. You know, he's a spoiled brat, to put it nicely, who's also, you know, arrogant, which I think the arrogance is a mask for tremendous insecurity.
So where do we stand then if we've the meeting Thursday night in Luxembourg with all the foreign ministers, which is supposed to make the deal, it breaks up in acrimony. There's a last-ditch effort going on Monday, apparently, and that's it, isn't it? I mean, you can't keep having these near-death experiences, can you?
No, I think it's pretty well over. As the head of the European Bank said, the Greek banks will be open tomorrow, but he's not sure they're going to be open on Monday. And what's interesting is I'm going to be in Greece on Sunday, so I'm wondering if, you know, I'm going to bring enough cash with me, because there may not be any banks to go to.
Well, maybe we should call you on Sunday, too.
By all means, I can. When we hang up, I can give you some contact numbers in Greece, and that'd be interesting.
No, we're back on the air on Sunday, so that would be good. Great. So let me reintroduce Andre Joly-Martos, who's the chair of Hellenic Studies at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, who focuses on the political and social history of modern Greece. But to be, you know, to give the Greek government at least a little bit of slack here, there is something deeply dysfunctional, don't you think, about this international finance system, where the irresponsible lenders never get punished, but the irresponsible borrowers do. And in the case of Greece's debt, the borrowing was done by previous governments, not by the Syriza governments.
Indeed. You know, I have a lot of respect for Mr. Tsipras. I've met him and I know him quite well. I may not agree with his politics on the far left, but as a man, I see he's a man of integrity, and he's walking a tightrope between, you know, a party that is not really a party, that it's a conglomerate of different interests, some of them extremely radical, certainly all of them left, some of them communist. And he's been trying to say, but he's been overshadowed by Varoufakis, that Greece has been put in a tight spot unfairly, and he's right. The EU policies of extreme austerity have done absolutely no good, except impose tremendous suffering on the Greek people. And the outcome of that suffering has been to vote for a party like Syriza, who otherwise, you know, would never have gotten elected, no matter how crazy Greek politics can be. At the same time, nobody seems to appreciate what you just said. I mean, all these governments and people and organizations loaned the various Greek governments tons of money. And I'll tell you how some of the money came to Greece. For example, the Greeks bought 3 German submarines about 6 years ago. The Germans loaned them the money to buy the submarines. And, you know, Greece didn't need 3 submarines, but it was part of a deal to get another loan. And, you know, the 3 submarines that they bought from the Germans cannot submerge because they all tilt. They also bought 1,000 Leopard tanks from the Germans. And, you know, Greece is a country of mountains, a lot of mountains. You don't need tanks to defend that country.
And a lot of water, too.
And tanks
don't float.
So they bought these tanks. And you know what the catch is? Well, there's no shells for them because the barrels are a particular size that, you know, German shells don't fit them. Again, it's money borrowed to buy those tanks. They borrowed money. The French loaned the money to buy a French frigate. You know, do they need a French frigate? Not really. So there's been a lot of corruption in Greece, but some of the corruption has been solicited by Germans, by Frenchmen, and by other Europeans. So it's been a mutual dance of economic destruction. And instead of recognizing that and trying to ameliorate it, they've been just putting all the blame on Greece. You know, quite honestly, I've been to Greece a lot, and I've never seen a lazy person there. I mean, I'm sure there must be, because it's a big country, I mean, in terms of the Balkans. But people work extremely hard to earn a living. And to be told that, you know, you're a lazy Southeastern European who's stupid, I think is quite insulting.
Well, this is, of course, this acrimony has led to a lot of tension between, as you were saying earlier, a lot of the personality of the finance minister in alienating the German finance minister was not helpful, shall we say. But the you know, when Syriza took over, they had a ceremony at a site where the Germans executed Greek patriots during the occupation. The occupation in World War II by Germany was quite brutal. There's no question about that. And when you said earlier about how, under normal circumstances, this government would not have been elected, I guess the only thing you can say is that, thank God, the right-wing Golden Dawn wasn't elected, right?
Exactly. Could have gone that way, too. And, you know, I'll give you an example from history. You know, in 1930, if Germany wasn't going through a massive economic depression and huge inflation, which is, by the way, why they don't like the idea of an inflation, although it is the cure for a lot of these financial ills, they elected the Nazis out of desperation because, you know, people were living off the streets. The middle class had disintegrated, and they reacted by going to anyone who would tell them that things will be better tomorrow. The same thing happened with Syriza and the Greeks, not that I'm comparing them to the Nazis. And in fairness to the Germans, the Greek media has been taking them to task about World War II, about war crimes, about this, about that, which has nothing to do with the economy. It has nothing to do with the money that they borrowed.
So can any of this stuff be walked back now? I mean, we're at the brink, and we've said, as we said earlier, there's been a lot of talk about being at the brink, and there's certainly been a lot of brinksmanship, but we really are at the brink, are we not?
We are indeed. I think the only step forward is for the Prime Minister to remove Varoufakis entirely from the negotiating team and take it on himself and go there and find some face-saving formula for both parties, you know, for the Europeans and for the Greeks. You know, maybe agree to a much later retirement date that the Greeks will not, you know, accuse him of giving in to the Europeans, and Merkel and company would not be accused by their people of, you know, giving way to the Greeks.
But the alternative of getting out of the euro and going back to the drachma is absolutely catastrophic. I think the Greek people know that, don't they?
A lot of them do. Some of them don't. You know, some of them are living in a kind of a state of denial. They don't realize not only will there won't be any money, but it's going to take about 3 months for the drachma to circulate. What happens in that interim period? How do you buy bread? How do you buy milk? There won't be any cash while they're printing new drachmas. They can't just print money. I think there's been the assumption in Europe and in Greece that, oh, well, you know, you go back to the drachma. Yeah, but that's easier said than done. And it would require all kinds of treaties and arrangements for financial institutions to recognize the drachma and put a value on it, right?
Well, it would mean that the pensions would be eviscerated, they'd be worthless. I mean, it's extraordinary.
Oh, yeah.
So there are still some people who think that this is possible. I mean, it's not as if Tsipras and Varoufakis have plan B, do they?
I'm wondering. I don't think they do. I think they really believe that they can stare down the Europeans and that the Europeans would back off because, you know, they would be afraid of a downturn in the European economy in general, which I think it will not be the case. I agree with a lot of the economists who said, yes, maybe, you know, for a week or so, markets are going to take a dive, and then people will realize that the world still exists without Greece, and they'll go their merry way, and the Greeks will be left with, as you said, a catastrophic situation.
And is that your feeling, what's going to happen?
I'm hoping that by some miracle, you know, on Monday, they find some modus vivendi between the two, and agree to at least an interim solution, because I think there's no possibility, you know, in a space of one day, or of one meeting, to have a long-term solution. But if they can find a solution for the end of June, so that $1.6 billion can somehow be paid in some fashion, it would avert a default.
Well, we're not talking about a lot of money, are we, really, in the overall scheme of things?
No, it's very little money indeed.
But compared to the catastrophe that the so-called Grexit, or the exit from the euro, would be, you'd think that rational heads would prevail.
Well, I'm hoping so. I mean, I hope the Europeans are, you know, look around the table and consider themselves lucky that they can walk away from this disaster for $1.6 billion, which is not, again, a lot of money.
Right. Well, there's obviously more, you know, I mean, in effect, they're borrowing money to pay back money already. So
yeah.
It's not a solution, but at least it's a Band-Aid to avoid, you know, yeah, catastrophic hemorrhaging.
Well, I think that's the only option for Monday, even if that is, you know, we can call it an option. I mean, they may not even agree to that, but it's probably the only possible solution.
Uh-huh. But there's a sense, though, isn't there, that the Europeans are getting fed up? That's what I read between the lines from this meeting breaking up in Luxembourg.
I sympathize. If I had to sit across the table from Varoufakis, I would, you know, be throwing things at him. You know, he's an obstinate and silly man. But they have to realize that as much as they can't stand the guy and as much as they can't stand the situation, they have a responsibility to their voters. They have a responsibility to the idea of Europe. They have a responsibility to the international community that we don't go down some hole because, you know, Schwab is annoyed with Varoufakis and vice versa.
Right. But you don't think then that there's any... A lot of people on the left think that this is being crushed because it is a leftist experiment. You don't buy that then?
No, not really, no. No. I think the Europeans are afraid of letting Tsipras off the hook and Syriza off the hook because their own left-wing parties will come forward in Spain and in Ireland and in Italy and in Portugal and, you know, say, aha, the Greek left did it in Greece, we can do it here. But giving them $1.6 billion is not giving, you know, support to the left. It's avoiding a banking crisis right now.
Right, but you do have Podemos in Spain that's rising fast. I mean, there is a political phenomenon underway, isn't there?
Indeed, there is, but Podemos has kind of backed away from Syriza, from the Greek left. Even they have found the Greek left has been ridiculously unrealistic in its demands.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, André Gerolimatos.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with André Gerolimatos, the Chair of Hellenic Studies at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, who focuses on the political and social history of modern Greece. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the Fund for Peace's latest report, Fragile States Index 2015.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound.
A mark, a yen,
a buck or a pound. Is all that makes the world go around. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is J.J. Mesner, who's the Executive Director of the Fund for Peace, where he just co-authored their latest report, Fragile States Index 2015, which is published by both the Fund for Peace and Foreign Policy magazine. Welcome to Background Briefing, J.J. Mesner.
Oh, thank you, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And this is the 11th year now that you've been publishing the Fragile States Index, and it's basically a joint venture, I guess, of the Fund for Peace and Foreign Policy, which takes stock of the year's events using 12 social, economic, and political indicators to analyze how wars, peace accords, environmental calamities, and political movements have pushed countries towards stability or closer to the brink of collapse. And the index ranks the countries according from the most fragile to the least. So I guess let's start with the most fragile, right? Let me quickly read them. South Sudan, Somalia, Central African Republic, Sudan, Democratic Republic of the Congo, Chad, Yemen, Afghanistan, Syria, and Guinea. And I guess in today's New York Times, there's a big front page story talking about the record displacement of people. 60 million people now are sort of on the move, homeless and without a country. And I take it that's also a part of this picture of failed and fragile states.
Yes. Well, I think what we've been able to determine is that in many ways, fragility begets fragility and stability begets stability. If one looks at the Fragile States Index, you can generally see that many of the countries that are at the fragile end of the index 1 year tend to be grouped at the same end of the index the following year. And, of course, the inverse is true as well. But that does paint perhaps a little bit too much of a negative picture for me to say that, because if one looks at the middle of the index, you can actually see a relatively decent amount of movement. And over the past 10 years, we've been mapping the improvements and the worsenings of countries across 178 countries. And what we've been able to determine is most years, the vast majority of countries will actually improve. So, for example, this year, if we compare between 2015 and 2014, probably about twice as many countries have improved their score over the year as have seen their score worsen. But nevertheless, that does neglect, of course, the fact that there are a number of countries that are facing significant fragility. And when you mentioned, Ian, the displacement of people without a country, that really is in many ways a symptom of state fragility in a number of parts of the world, but particularly in some of those countries that you mentioned, like, for example, South Sudan and Somalia, Central African Republic and Sudan, where you really see a lot of displacement, a lot of insecurity, and really what we would say epitomized fragility.
And, of course, you have to add to that Syria, which was a fairly developed state, which has been systematically destroyed. I mean, it's a tragedy, both in terms of the destruction of a state and the dislocation of its people.
Oh, absolutely. And on our rankings this year, Syria again ranks as one of the three most worsened countries year on year. And in terms of our decade trends, Syria is also one of a handful of the most worsened, indeed is the second most worsened since 2006, if one looks at decade trends. But of course, you know, looking at the data, really does belie the human tragedy that is occurring behind it. Not only is this conflict having just horrible effects on the Syrian people, but also it's taking its toll on its neighbors as well. The conflict in Syria is, of course, impacting the stability of Iraq. It's having impacts on the stability of Turkey. And so I think it's important that when we look at countries, we are doing so in isolation, and it's important to recognize that in the world in which we live, in a globalized world with relatively porous borders when it comes to pressures like this, that fragility can occur in a neighborhood as much as it does in any one state.
Well, indeed, the refugee pressure on Jordan, which is already suffering from refugees from the previous Iraq war, the Palestinian refugees, water shortages, basically the country's being overwhelmed. So, but let's talk about some of the bright spots here, just so that we don't get too into despair. In your new survey that just came out, Fragile States Index for 2015, you say that the bright spots are Cuba, Georgia, and Portugal.
That's right. Cuba has not only been ranked as the most improved country since 2014, but it's also our most improved country in the history of the index ever since we started compiling it back in 2005. So it would be easy, I think, to look at the improvement of Cuba since 2014 and conclude that maybe that improvement has been driven by the thawing of relations with the United States. And certainly, I think the case can be made that the thawing of relations is certainly contributing to the improving fortunes of Cuba. The fact that we can chart a decade-long trend of improvement for Cuba really does demonstrate that this improvement is happening in isolation of the thawing of relations with America. And particularly when we see a country that is improving by such significant strides, not only year on year, but over a long, a prolonged period of time, I think we can conclude that there is a certain amount of sustained improvement, which is definitely good news for Cuba and particularly the Cuban people. Because as I say, you know, we see countries being somewhat cyclical in their improvements, and perhaps they might get worse again a year after and then improve again. But when it's a prolonged trajectory of improvement, that is where we can really start to be much more cautiously optimistic, I think, about a country.
And again, I'm speaking with J.J. Messner, who is the Executive Director of the Fund for Peace, where he just co-authored their latest report, Fragile States Index 2015, which is published by both the Fund for Peace and Foreign Policy magazine. On today's program, you preceded by an interview on the very, very fragile state of Greece, with the Greek Central Bank warning that the exit from the euro is fast approaching. Does Greece come up on your index?
It certainly does. Now, of course, this is an important nuance that we always make clear in using our index, and I would make this clear to your listeners that, of course, you know, when one looks at the rankings and one looks at the very high alert and the high warning categories and so forth, and there's very few countries that one would describe as developed countries within those rankings. But it's much more informative to look at the trends and to look at the year-on-year trends I've already discussed. And if we look at a country like Greece, we can see that over the past decade, Greece is our 10th most worsened country. Out of 178 countries worldwide, Greece is the 10th most worsened of them all since 2006. And you know, I think when we talk of state fragility, too often I think people are tempted to think of countries in the developing world, countries in the Great Lakes region or countries in the Middle East that are beset by conflict. But I think what Greece demonstrates to us is that fragility really knows no bounds, and fragility can strike any country if it doesn't have the ability to cope with those pressures. And Greece is a great example, well, actually I shouldn't say a great example, a rather unfortunate example of just this fact, that Greece has fallen significantly. By our rankings, it has fallen 11.5 points, and that's on a 120-point scale. So hopefully that gives some sense of the scale of the decline in Greece. Now, given the current situation with negotiations between the Greek government and the IMF and other financial authorities and the European Union and so forth, given that the data period that we've been analyzing Greece on ended on December 31st, 2014, given the events so far in 2015, I think that would suggest that Greece is likely to be on a continued negative trajectory when we put together the 2016 Fragile States Index a year from now. So it certainly is a very concerning picture for Greece. And indeed, it was one of the countries that we wrote a feature on this year. We did do a little bit more of an in-depth assessment of Greece and really charted its performance again, some of the other European countries that face similar financial difficulties but have actually begun to improve. And so to contrast against Greece, I would be clear that the equal most improved country this year is Portugal. A European country that faced similar economic issues had to institute similar austerity reforms, and yet now it has made massive improvements. So I would use Portugal as an interesting case study, therefore, to compare and contrast against against Greece.
And in terms of, you mentioned the high alert category, Nigeria was in that high alert category last year, but now you're saying that things are turning around with the new government and with Boko Haram on the run. Although I might add that it's not all rosy, because the new government, supposedly a very uncorruptible leader, former general, they've apparently put through the parliament a bill giving the parliamentarians a $42 million wardrobe allowance in a country where people subsist on a dollar a day. So I wouldn't say they're totally out of the woods in terms of corruption.
Well, certainly, and there's definitely a lot of pressure on Nigeria. They are in our high alert category. They actually did worsen by a couple of points over the past year. And really that comes down to the Boko Haram terrorist threat up in the north, and also the rising tensions that we saw leading up to the presidential election. And the Fund for Peace actually has quite significant in-country programs in both in the Niger Delta, the Middle Belt, and up in the north of the country as well. So we not only are assessing Nigeria at the very high level, our own organization has an on-the-ground presence there where we can see much of this for ourselves. And as much as there is still plenty of pressure on Nigeria and there's still much to be concerned about, there is also much to be hopeful about. And I know that might sound a little strange to your listeners, for me to be saying that a country in the high alert category that has worsened as one of the top 10 most worsened countries in 2014, for me to be saying there's much to be hopeful for might sound quite surprising, but I think that there is. If you look at the election this year, yes, we did register significant rising tensions ahead of the election, but we saw a peaceful transition of power. And I hope that my hope is that that will be reflected in hopefully an improved score for Nigeria next year. And also, if you contrast Nigeria to its West African neighbors, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea all worsened significantly due to Ebola. And if you take into account Nigeria's response to Ebola, Lagos, an incredibly heavily populated city, was threatened by Ebola. But yet Nigeria demonstrated that it had capacity within its health ministries, within its public authorities in Lagos, to actually contain the threat. And I think in doing so, saved many lives and also saved the country from increased instability and fragility. So as much as there is much to be concerned about in Nigeria, there is also much to be hopeful for as well.
Well, let's bring this conversation into the context of the United States, given that we're talking about failed states and failing states and a few, as you've mentioned, who have improved. But I find it fascinating that you ask in the study, if Ferguson, Missouri were a country, would it be a fragile state? And the answer is Ferguson scored 62.6 on the Fragile State Index, putting the town of 21,000 among the ranks of countries like Botswana, Brunei, and Brazil in the warning category. So we're certainly, you know, what's the biblical expression? He is without sin casting the first stone. The other thing that I find fascinating about your study in terms of the United States is that you point out that the United States suffers from one of the indexes, the factionalization of elites. I've never heard that phrase before, but it's I think a perfect way to describe gridlock and our polarized and dysfunctional Capitol Hill.
Yes, exactly, and I would agree with you on that. When we define factionalization of elites in a very colloquial way, we'll basically say, well, it's the inability of lawmakers to productively work together. And I think that that is exactly what we see in in federal politics in America. And I think that in terms of America's score and its trends, you're really starting to see that reflected somewhat. But I would say, though, that for a country like America to have such factionalization at the political level, but to still be able to maintain the level of stability it does, really does speak to the resiliency of its governance and its rule of law, that even with a relatively dysfunctional political system, the country still manages to keep on ticking and to remain quite prosperous. So I think that really speaks greatly to the resiliency of the American people. But, you know, to your point about us looking at Ferguson, Missouri as a city, and that was definitely an interesting case study, and we did a similar one a couple of years ago when we looked at Detroit when it declared bankruptcy and tried to ascertain how Detroit would look if it were a country. And I think that this really serves two purposes. You know, for an index that is created by an American organization, I think that we've got to be careful to ensure that we're giving every country a fair shake, that every country is being assessed equally, whether it is a country on the other side of the world or it's the country that we're based in. And America, like any country, is going to face a unique set of pressures, and we hope that a country would be able to face those pressures. But it also speaks to the great variance across a country as well. When one looks at the Fragile States Index, the country scores really are an average of that entire country. So when we give a country a particular score, there's going to be parts of that country that are much better and parts of that country that are going to be a lot more fragile. So looking at the score for the United States, there's certainly going to be parts of the country, like, for example, Ferguson, Missouri, or Detroit a couple of years ago, that are a lot more fragile. But there again, there's going to be parts of the country that are a whole lot more stable. So that really does speak to the very broad assessment for a country, which at the end of the day really does come down to an average that doesn't necessarily directly represent any one individual part of the country, but really is, as I say, an average of them all.
Well, just in closing, how do our listeners get hold of this report?
Well, they can go to our website, which is Fund for Peace, FundForPeace.org. There's plenty of analysis there. There's the past 11 years' worth of statistics and data that's available there. And also, I'd like to plug our partners, Foreign Policy. I think that they've put together a tremendous feature on the Fragile States Index this year. And so I'd encourage your listeners to also check out their analysis at foreignpolicy.com.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, J.J. Messner.
Thank you, Ian. It's been a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with J.J. Messner, who's the Executive Director of the Fund for Peace, where he just co-authored their latest report, Fragile States Index 2015, which is published by both the Fund for Peace and by Foreign Policy Magazine. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Oceana Christopher. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Baby,